Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Rico Muhammad coming to you live from Atlanta, Georgia. And tonight we have our very special guest, transportation attorney extraordinaire, Mr. Henry Seaton, will be joining us tonight to answer any and all of your transportation legal questions. If you have any questions regarding such things as tunnel fees, rejected loads, detention, contracts, now is the excellent opportunity for you to get a chance to get on and talk to someone that knows the legal ramifications and the legal statutes that surround those type of situations. So if you want to get in and ask your question directly to Mr. Seaton, go ahead and press the number one that will put you in the queue, and we will be able to screen your call and get you up live so that you can ask your question directly and get direct information from a transportation attorney, not lunch counter truck information, but get some real valid transportation attorney information from Mr. Henry Seaton himself. He's on the line, and he will be joining us here in just a second. But we will start out tonight's Freight and Lanes podcast as we normally do, and we'll try and run through this really quickly because we don't want to cut into any time with Mr. Seaton. Whenever he comes on, he's a wealth of knowledge, and we love to pick his brain and get some information that will help us better our business. So to this week on the USDA Fruit and Vegetable Truck Rate Report, we don't have any markets that are reporting any shortages. We have a couple of markets that are reporting slight shortages. Those counties are Idaho, Merrill County, Oregon, County Maine, Michigan, New York, and Columbia Basin, Washington. Just wanted to breeze through that real quickly on the Fruit and Vegetable Truck Rate Report. Go to Google and Google Fruit and Vegetable Truck Rate Report. There's a lot more information in that report that we do not cover. We tried to get into it a little bit last week, but we don't cover it in depth here on this podcast. But you are able to go and get that report for yourself. You can glean whatever information you can from that. It's a wealth of knowledge to be had in there. If you're going to start looking into pulling any type of produce or anything, I highly recommend that you check that report out. Moving really quickly right on into this week's DAT Trend Lines report. For this week, we are looking at March 8th through the 14th, and freight availability added 4.2% last week, and capacity increased 7.6%, and the load-to-truck ratio declined for vans and reefers, and their average rates were unchanged. Flatbed ratios increased, so did the rates. So let's get into each one of those particular segments, and we will start out with the U.S. van demand and capacity numbers for the week of the 8th through the 14th. For dry van freight availability increased 2.5% last week, and truckload capacity added 7.4%. This usually move in opposite directions. The load-to-truck ratio declined 4.6% from 3.7 to 3.5 loads per truck, despite the increased load volume. February capacity added 0.5%. The load-to-truck ratio averaged 2.6 for vans in February, a 6.6 decline compared to January. Load availability slipped 6.1% and capacity added 0.5% month over month compared to a typical demand in February of 2014. Last month's ratio was off by 52%. Moving on to U.S. van rate information. The van rates were unchanged at $1.94 per mile last week, a national average, as outbound rates declined in Buffalo but rose in Los Angeles and Dallas. February rates were down year over year. The monthly average van rate slipped 6 cents compared to January due partially to a decline in the fuel surcharge. Compared to February of 2014, the total rate was down 10 cents from $1.98 to $1.88 per mile, including the fuel. Quickly, checking in across the country, we start out in the Northeast Corridor. The average van rate in the Northeast Corridor for dry vans was $1.82. The average dry van rate in the Mid-Atlantic and the Southeast region was $2 per mile. And for dry vans, the high water mark was coming out of the Midwest, out of Chicago, at $2.16 per mile on average. In the central region, southwest central region, shows $1.80 per mile on average. and coming out on the West Coast out of Los Angeles shows a $1.99 per mile average. Moving on quickly to U.S. flatbed demand. Flatbed load availability rose 12% last week, and capacity added 53%. Two metrics typically move in opposite directions. The load-to-truck ratio increased 6.3% from 13.9 to 14.8 loads per truck. Flatbed demand dips 3.7%, load volume dip 3.7% for flatbeds in February compared to January, and capacity increased 3.6%, yielding a 7% decline in the load-to-truck ratio month over month. The ratio slid 52% compared to February of 2014, when extreme weather led to a typical demand for all equipment types last year. And moving on to the U.S. flatbed rate information for March 8th through the 14th, national average flatbed rates recouped 3 cents last week, rising to $2.15 per mile as the national average. There was no change in the fuel surcharge compared to the previous week. The national average rate for flatbeds again fell 8 cents. That's a 3.1% change in February to $2.13 per mile compared to February of 2014. Flatbed rate slipped 7 cents. That was a 3.2% change per mile, mostly due to declining fuel surcharges. Quickly checking in across the country, starting out in the Northeast Corridor, the national average for flatbeds, the target city is Harrisburg, shows an average of $3.65 per mile for flatbeds, which is the high water mark. The Southeast region coming out of the Atlanta area showing an average of $2.41 per mile. Midwest, Rock Island is the target city showing an average of $2.57 per mile. Houston, Texas represents the central and southwestern part of the United States showing an average of $2.25 per mile in that region. And Phoenix, Arizona is the West Coast representative showing an average of $1.69 per mile coming out of the West Coast division of the United States. Moving quickly over into the U.S. reefer demand for March 8th through the 14th, demand for reefers dipped 3% last week and capacity increased 11%. The load-to-truck ratio declined 12% as a result, dropping from 11 back to 9.6 loads per truck. Reefer load availability declined 14% and capacity added 1.7% in February compared to January. The resulting load-to-truck ratio dipped 15% from 9.1 to 7.7. Compared to the extreme weather-driven demand of February 2014, the ratio declined 51%. Moving on and wrapping this report up, we're going to jump into the reefer rates, and the national reefer rates were stable. The national average for reefers was unchanged from last week. Shows a national average of $2.16 per mile for reefers. Reefer rates dropped 12 cents in February compared to the January national average and lost 8 cents compared to 2014. So, quickly, around the country, Elizabeth, New Jersey is the East Coast representative up in the Northeast, showing an average of $2.21 per mile. Coming out of Lakeland, Florida, showing a $1.66 per mile average. Green Bay sets the high water mark, coming out of the Midwest, showing a $3.05 per mile average. McAllen, Texas is going to be the South Central representative, showing a $2.04 per mile average. And coming out of Fresno for reefers, showing an average rate of $1.93 per mile coming out of the West Coast in Fresno. And that pretty much wraps up
the
number for the rates. And with no further ado, let's see if we can grab Mr. Seaton and bring him up on board.
You should report the guy to all the credit services for what he did so that everybody else is forewarned.
How you doing, Mr. Seaton?
I'm doing fine. I've had a couple of questions. I didn't know whether we were live or not.
No, we had you in the cue room, so I apologize. I've had you in the cue room with my, and I probably should put you on hold.
Okay.
So you've been answering questions in the background all along, huh?
Yeah, I had a couple.
Okay, good deal. Well, we'll get those callers, we'll get them back up, and we'll get them in here in just a second. Wanted to just check in real quickly with you and introduce everybody to you. Mr. Seaton is, like I say, the leading transportation attorneys. If you have any questions, anything tonight, go ahead and press number one. We can get you up in the queue. Also wanted to give Mr. Seaton a chance. Hank, you want to tell everybody your website and give them your information or contact information if you like?
Sure. Our website is pretty simple. It's transportationlaw.net. If you have time and like to play around the internet, you can see that there are over, I guess, 200 articles that I've written over the past few years on a wide range of topics. It's fairly well indexed. It's free. It doesn't cost you anything. If you'd like to look around, maybe you got a question, maybe it'll be answered. I guess that's good enough. It'll give you my bio and our firm and what we do. It's pretty wide-based in terms of representing motor carriers, large and small, and the kinds of issues that have been asked so far tonight, collection issues, truck ordered, not used, just general transportation law. I've been doing it for 40 years, so I remember the good old days and the bad times as well. I guess that's enough of an intro. Rico, we can go to questions if you want to.
All right, yeah, we got a gentleman that's got his hand raised right now calling in from, I guess it looks like my daughter's trying to get ready to screen that call, but I'm a bop her out of there and see if we can bring him up. We don't have his name. Caller calling in from the 605 area code. Hello, caller. Okay, we'll put him back on hold. Not sure he had quite a bit of background noise. We'll put him back on hold and see if we can get him screened, see if we can get him back to the phone. I had a couple of questions off of Facebook, Mr. Seaton, that came up. Got one coming in that says, what options does a carrier have after loaded? The broker changes the delivery date and time and refuses to pay the carrier detention and or layover rates. Am I looking
that may be,
for
that
any
may be the same
return?
Gentleman I just got through talking to. And the answer before we went live is, unless you negotiate as part of the load confirmation sheet, truck ordered and not used, you'll have a hard time getting paid. Clearly, if he changes the pickup time, and other terms and conditions, you can tell him to suck eggs and not do business with him. You're under no obligation to accept the load if he didn't fulfill his bit. But it's important that you incorporate your accessorial somehow into the contract with the broker at time of pickup or at time of booking, or you're going to play hell getting him to be a nice guy and pay you. Now, some of the reputable people will certainly do it. They feel some level of obligation, and they would want to keep their carrier clientele around, but you don't have a legal right to insert on it. Other than, of course,
okay,
you could say, well, the guy's in breach of his contract. He promised me a load, and he should have foreseen the damages. But litigating that's going to be problematic. Most courts are going to say if you don't have it in writing, you don't have aren't entitled to it.
Okay, let me give you a follow up to this, because there has been some, and I understand that's why we have you on here, because you are an attorney. But we have some people that are teaching some things as far as with some of the different home based brokering programs and things like that. And I've heard them give advice that says, well, just invoice them. Just go ahead and invoice them. And I know for a fact that that doesn't necessarily work out too well for you, but if you want to kind of maybe debunk some of that or give us some clarity on that, that would be great as well.
Well, I mean, Rico, I could invoice you for this hour. We didn't agree you were going to pay me anything, and I wouldn't expect you to send me a big fat check. I mean, certainly you could. It is a technique, and I have seen it done for people to invoice the broker for a truck ordered not used. And you know, you can make a cogent case that you know, with a note that says I did hit the truck 150 miles out of route at you know, at $1.50 a mile, you owe me you know, $225. Clearly, if you're going to invoice somebody, you need to come up with some reasonable basis for what your damages are. And, you know, I'm not against trying. I'm just saying that as a legal matter, I don't think you've got a right to enforce anything.
So you could not file, just for clarity, and I think we've covered this a little bit before in some previous podcasts, but we've got some, we're constantly trying
to
roll.
Let me give you a better example. I am asked for a surety to monitor their broker bonds. And if you were to file a bond claim on a broker for a truck ordered and not used, and a set amount, and sent to me, here's the invoice, he canceled the load, my letter back to you was, show me that you agreed to an accessorial charge of truck order not used. Most likely, if the broker called me in and said I never agreed to it, I would end up telling the carrier, I can't in good faith pay the claim. If you get a judgment against the guy, for whatever reason, we'll certainly honor it. So I'm just saying, based upon, you know, what would be my role as an arbiter in that situation, if you made a bond claim against him, unless you could prove that it was incorporated into the contract of carriage, the bond claim wouldn't be paid. And that's about, you know, that's about as far as I can go telling you, other than you can sue. I think you'll have a hard time. You'll have a hard time prevailing. That's why, yes, you know, I told people that have been on the list before, and I told the guy who was on, yes, I understand that, you know, brokers don't want to agree to any kind of accessorial charges, but hopefully we'll be more successful in getting accessorials built into the contract on the front end. You know, this is just the front end of the situation where a poor carrier has got a delivery appointment on Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock and the consignee's closed and nobody wants to pay detention. There's no reference of it in the contract.
Right. And we got a couple more callers with some questions, got their hands raised, so we're going to try and go directly to them. Caller calling in from the 254 area code. You're on live with Hank and Rico. How can we help?
Yeah. What's the purpose of a blind bill of lading? I've been on a couple runs that last year, six, and they give me a blind bill of lading. And is it legal?
It is legal when it most often happens. I see it in what's called freight diverting. And what is going on is the person who is hiring you or hiring the broker does not want the consignee to know from whom the product came. Let's assume for the sake of argument that it's perfectly good canned goods, but that it's being sold by what we call a freight diverter. And there are situations in which maybe a large chain grocery house will buy more canned goods than they can consume because they get a volume discount. Now they turn around and want to sell it to somebody else, and they want to hide the origin. Well, you know, the carrier is kind of being asked to be complicit in that. There's nothing illegal about it. It does, in fact, occur. But I was a professional witness in a case for a grocery store, a wholesale grocery house, that woke up one day and found out that its major customer was diverting the freight and that the motor carrier that they were hiring was in bed with the diverter. And the lawsuit was against the motor carrier. And, you know, my opinion was that it was unethical because there is a thing called the truth in billing requirements. If you're hired by some third party to deliver it and the third party tells you to execute another bill of lading, you're probably not in violation of anything. But if you are party of perpetrating a fraud on the guy who hires you because somebody else wants you to deliver it to a different location, then I'd be very reluctant to do it. This whole issue of freight diverting is kind of a cheesy idea. The manufacturers hate it because they want to be able to give their volume discounts to people who are actually going to use the product, not people who are going to resell it.
Okay.
Hopefully that explanation makes some sense.
It does now. Let's suppose that I'm on the East Coast, and the first receiver on my bill of lading is in the South, but it ends up in the West Coast. If I get caught with a bill of lading going the wrong direction by the cops, what happens then? You understand my question?
Sure, I do. You know, if I were you, I would, to protect myself, want on the truck some email or some evidence that the shipment has been reconsigned. Okay, because that's what's really happened. The shipper gave you a bill of lading that said it was going to Miami, but actually somebody else reconsigned it to California.
Right.
And, you know, if the guy stops you and says, buddy, what are you doing going to Florida, in California, when this says you're going to Florida, you say this shipment was reconsigned. Here's my contract from whatever. But, you know, as a matter of fact, I haven't seen that in years. It used to be that when everybody had limited authority, and the ICC was concerned about enforcing economic regulation, that happened. Now I think they're really just concerned with the fact that you've got license and insurance to handle it, and certainly that you're not stealing the load. I haven't had a call ever about somebody being stopped on the fact that the freight had been diverted.
Okay.
Usually what happens is, you know, you're asked to make out a delivery receipt that shows something else. And I guess if you've got your proposed delivery receipt that shows it's consigned to Sacramento, that ought to be sufficient. LTL carriers, of course, frequently, will get a master bill of lading that shows that the truckload's consigned to Chicago, and then their little LTL bills that, may actually be what they're out on the road with the ship being delivered to some point beyond. So it's just not untypical for the original bill of lading not being the document that the shipment's delivered on. The only argument that I know, and that's what came up in this case, is this truth in billing. If you're going to bill a guy for services provided, you need to accurately tell him where the shipment went. Particularly if he was paying you to take it there, you need to take it there, and you don't need to be monkeying around with giving him the false impression that the load went to some place it didn't. Paying your bill.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.
let's see here. We'll put him back on hold so he can stay on and listen. And let's try the caller again from the 605 area code to see if we can get him. Caller from the 605, you're on live with Rico and Hank. What's your question? How can we help? Hello, caller.
Is this me?
That's you.
Yes, sir, it is.
Oh,
you.
Wow. Okay, I didn't even push the button, but I'm okay, Rico. Joe Cox, how are you?
I'm well, Joe. How about yourself?
Oh, not too bad, not too bad. My question is regarding last week's call, not on your show, but on another one, where somebody was bringing up that if you had an issue, you could, since you basically own the freight on the trailer, you could sell that freight, but not at a profit, but for the cargo. Well, my question is, if you have $100,000 worth of TVs on that and you sell it for the freight rate of $3,000, who's going to get the bill for the $100,000 worth of TVs?
I'll jump in on that one. You have got a lien on shipments in your possession for payment of the freight charges of that ship. So,
yes,
in other words, if you get a shipment, and for whatever reason you now want the load to be paid because you don't trust the broker, you can put that on COD and you can insist that you're paid. If you're not paid, you assert your lien and you have to give notice to the beneficial owner and the broker that you're going to sell it in accordance with the UCC unless they discharge your lien. And then when you do sell it, you've got to sell it under commercially reasonable procedures, and you can deduct your freight charges on that load, but you sure in the heck can't sell $100,000 worth of TVs for $3,000.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too,
you've got an obligation
to mitigate
damages and sell it for the maximum value. Now, there is distressed merchandise all the time in which, let's say, a consignee rejects a shipment and there's really nothing wrong with it, and you issue an on-hand notice that says, look, this is wrongfully rejected, I'm going to sell it for best advantage and deduct my freight charges, and I'll send the beneficial owner the rest, but I'm not going to pay his cargo claim. But that doesn't mean that, you can go out and call your brother-in-law up, say, man, can I give you a hell of a deal on $100,000 worth of TV? You send me $3,000, and we'll stick this guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what show you were on, but I may not call somebody out. But that sounds like pretty sloppy advice to me.
Yeah, that's what
now,
I was thinking
another,
too.
I got with the new guys out here,
you'd be in trouble.
Well, I got another caveat to add to that, Mr. Seaton, because we talked and you kind of addressed it a little earlier about asserting your trying to get your rule circular in there for your accessorials and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And before, on our previous podcast, we've always talked about always trying to, get that rule circular and being able to read and the thing that you talk about in your book, which we need to plug that as well, protect the motor carrier's interests and contracts. But you talk about the Dirty Dozen, and that goes when you're dealing with broker loads. If you sign a lot of these broker agreements and stuff, how much of your rights you're signing away by those agreements? So you may not even have the authority to even usurp your lien.
Most of those contracts, waiver of liens is one of the typical provisions that are in shipper and broker contracts. I'll just tell you guys that are on the line. I guess it's Monday of next week, I'm making a presentation to a fairly good-sized shipper and broker group, and maybe y'all need to pray for me. I may get stoned, because I am going to tell them that there is a new day coming, that the FMCSA is going to constrict the number of drivers on the road, and that, in my opinion, the shipping community is going to have to stop trying to cram down unreasonable service terms and conditions on carriers, and that, carriers are going to, because of the supply and demand, be able to assert their rights and things like, we'll pay you in 60 days if we want to. You'll indemnify us even if we cause the damage. You'll waive recourse to the consignor so we don't have to pay you. All of these kinds of things that we have just typically accepted over the past few years are going to change. And I know that they're changing for the larger carriers who can be choosy. And, you know, I truly hope that the silver lining to the FMCSA running more and more carriers out of the business is going to be those who can survive will not have to sign these terrible agreements and will be able to level the playing field in negotiating these terms and conditions. And I really think we're just about at the tipping point on that. I think the shippers and brokers have pushed it about as far as they can, and that even a small carrier needs to pay better attention to the terms and conditions under which he's taking freight.
So, Joe, did you have anything else, or was that it?
No, that answered the question there, Rico and Hank, so I appreciate it. Y'all have a good night.
Sure.
Oh, thank you, Joe. We'll put you back on hold. And Mr. Seaton, just kind of like we got a ton of callers and questions tonight, and I'm coming to you, callers. Just be patient with me. But I just want to follow up really quickly just to on that point that you just made. You know, and I've been kind of seeing this, have been listening to me, that no one forces us to do anything. And over the past years, we have given up so much ground. The motor carrier community has given up so much ground. And if things are starting to turn back, you know, all markets go through cycles, you know, where you got to, you know, in real estate, they use the term a buyer's market, a seller's market, or whatever. And right now, I feel like the pendulum is swinging back to the side of the motor carrier, but we have to take it while that pendulum is swinging back in our direction. We are going to have to take advantage of that momentum and start standing our grounds on certain things. And that's really, I like to, you know, publicly thank you for coming on and answering these questions and taking these calls from, you know, just us one and two guy truck operations, so that we know where our legal footing and our legal ground is, and we're not taking, you know, you help demystify a lot of the minutia that is out there and helps get everybody, you know, hopefully. You can take advice, whatever free advice, whatever it's worth. You know what I mean? But taking it from someone that's a trained attorney that does this for a living, I think that speaks for itself. So I just, again, like to publicly thank you for coming on and taking these questions and helping us out in this fashion.
Sure.
We got Elizabeth coming in right now. She has a follow-up question, so we're going to bring up Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Rico.
You're on live with Hank and yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Rico. I'm Mr. Seaton. Thank you for having me on tonight. My question
tonight
is a follow-up. Thank you. My question was kind of a follow-up to some of the things you were talking about earlier, Rico. And if I have expressly put my detention rate in the rate confirmation upon, you know, when I sign it and send it back to the broker, and at that point, I guess I would accept that if he accepts that and loads my truck then the following day, that we're in agreement with that. And at that point, then once my truck's loaded and en route, and there's an issue of detention is already arising, what kind of recourse do I have? Because I look at it as we've entered into a contract now, but I had a situation just the other day where they absolutely refused.
So what you're telling me is he sent you a contract. You you signed the contract, but you modified it by putting in the detention and the other stuff. You sent it back to him. While he didn't countersign it as accepting it, he nonetheless loaded you.
Yes.
Okay, I think that you've got a pretty good argument that he offered you a load. You countered his offer by saying, I'll take it if you provide me with the truck order to not use and the detention. That he obviously received that. That then his act of tendering you the load is his acceptance of your counteroffer. I think legally that's the way that goes. Now, he can absolutely refuse, but, you know, you can make a claim on his bond.
I can, okay.
And I think you can make a claim on his bond. The bondsman may say, well, he contested, and I'm not going to pay it unless you get a judgment. But at that point, it may very well be worth it to, we had an earlier call, somebody had the same question, and their problem was, well, if I get a judgment, how can I collect it? In your case, if you do have to take it to court, you can take it to small claims court. You can prevail and then go against the bond.
Okay.
So
now,
I think you did modify the contract.
Yes.
I think his act of tender is acceptance.
Okay. Now, I think at this time I've kind of shut the door on that, because after that then he sent me, he basically told me, we're not going to pay that, you have no recourse, you have nothing, and this was over the weekend. I didn't look into it probably as good as I could have during the week. So I accepted another rate confirmation with a much lower rate than I would have wanted to, based on him offering me a little bit more. At this point now, I have to just accept that and move on. Is that correct? Or can the original contract?
If you basically negotiate a settlement and then executed a new contract agreeing to accept less, you just got bullied.
Okay, very good. Well, I will keep that in mind for next time. I will stand my ground. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
And before I let you go, Elizabeth, I just wanted to let you know that now, Mr. Seaton, you remember the gentleman that we had on with us the last time you was on, Kenny? Elizabeth is his wife.
Yes. Okay, great.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Mr. Seaton, another thing that we were talking about, I'm listening as you're talking and answering these questions and going back to the book that you wrote, Protecting Motor Carriers' Interests and Contracts. By the way, everybody, if you want a copy of that book, please go to Mr. Seaton's website, transportationlaw.net. Is that correct, Mr. Seaton?
Yeah, that's right. And there's a place on there where you can order it.
You can order the book, or you can order to download
online. We've got some hard copies of the book left that we found. I think there may be 30, but you can either get a download or a copy of the book if you prefer. But just go to the website, and my office will take care of it for you.
And just following up on that point that you were talking about getting a judgment. Now, if you sign a broker contract, one of the provisions that I always see in a lot of these broker contracts as well is the Homer provision, is what you call it. If you decide to do any type of litigation or whatever, you basically have to do it on their home turf in their home state. Am I correct when I'm assuming when I read that? Am I correct? And if you're going to try to go after a judgment on what that previous situation, would you have to do it in their home state?
Yeah, that can nullify your judgment. If you let's assume that on the situation that Elizabeth was asking, that she had decided she could had a good cause of action. Certainly, she would want to sue the guy in her home state. She could go sue, get the judgment, then go make a filing with the against the bond. The broker could come in and say, well, look at the contract. It says the judgment's not valid because it wasn't brought in Minnesota. And at that point, you might have spent yourself some money and chased your tail, and the broker still said you don't have a valid judgment because the Homer provision said you had to sue this guy in Minnesota. So that's another example of where the Homer provision you're talking about makes it just damn difficult for you to get your legal rights over small claims matters. It allows the shipper or the broker to take the position, well, you know, possession's 9/10 of the law and I've got your money. The other 10th is come to Michigan to litigate.
And I kind of put up past couple of weeks, there's a funny little scene at the end of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory where they talk about, you know, the provision in there where little Charlie was expecting to get his lifetime supply of chocolate, and Willy Wonka pulled out the contract on him and went through the contract and would tell him that you know, you lose. You didn't read the contract that you signed. And this is one of the things that we have to be mindful of as small business people dealing with brokers and signing these contracts. We got to be mindful of what it is that we're signing and not to sign away our rights, which is, you know, like I say, once again, we appreciate you for coming on and helping us kind of navigate through these muddy waters that we got out here. Going back to the phone lines, we got quite a few callers and questions still here. Let's see. We're going to go to caller calling in from the area code 863. Caller calling in from 863, you're on live with Rico and Hank. How can we help? Hello, caller. All right, we'll put him back on hold. We'll go to the next one. We got Jason calling in that has a question. Let's go to Jason. Jason, you're on live with Rico and Hank. How can we help?
How you doing, Rico? Mr. Hank, how you doing?
Doing fine.
Well, I had a question about a independent contractor. I work for a company that I am an independent contractor, but this is not my truck. I don't pay for any, you know, any repairs or nothing like that. Is that a legal contract? Because I signed it, but it's illegal.
Well, it probably would not pass muster with either the states or the feds. The reason for that is in the federal regime, in terms of withholding and federal benefits, there is what's called a 20-point test to determine whether you're an employee or an independent contractor.
Okay.
A driver who does not own or have responsibility for a bona fide lease of equipment just can't meet that 20-part test.
Okay.
Under most state governments, state laws, it's probably even more difficult. Some of them have the 20-point control test. Some have an ABC test, under which they'll even classify a guy who owns his own truck as an employee. But it would be very difficult for me to see how a trucking company could say, well, we did not pay workman's comp benefits on this driver, or we didn't pay unemployment compensation and all of the other taxes on him, because we considered him to be a bona fide independent contractor, even though he didn't lease us equipment. I know that there are people, and I hear about them all the time, that have said, well, just because I pay you by the mile and not by the hour, you can be an independent contractor. But I think that the federal and state law would probably run the other way if that was challenged.
Okay. And I get paid by the percentage. I get 20% of the load. And another question that I had about the load, I don't see how much the loads pay. All I get is a text message telling me how much the load paid, but I talked to the broker, and I talked to several
brokers.
Yeah,
well, you see, here's the thing. If you were leasing equipment to the carrier, then under the truth in leasing regulations, you would have a right to see what the load paid, because a typical owner-operator who owns the equipment gets the pass-through on the fuel surcharge and something like 70% of the gross revenue. And they have the right to see the rated freight bill. Now, you know, at this point, you know, if you're not happy, you know, they're whistleblowing things. I mean, I'm primarily a carrier rep, and it's not I'm not someone going around here trying to tell everybody who's unhappy with the deal they ought to go to the IRS and the state people and turn the guy in. But, you know, the deal you've got is pretty egregious. It's pretty egregious, and you know, from your point of view, let's face it, workman's comp is here in case you're injured on the job. And, you know, you can be just as injured on the job driving his truck as an independent contractor as if you're working for him. So, I mean, there's certain social benefits that you're not getting And the other thing is, you know, the deal about being your own businessman and owning your own truck is, hey, you're an entrepreneur. There's not a whole lot of entrepreneurship or chance to get ahead that you really got if you're just getting paid 20% of we know not what to drive a truck.
And one more thing, let me assure you,
you know, if you got a halfway decent driving record there, you are a precious commodity. You don't have to submit to that kind of stuff.
Okay. Absolutely. Okay. One more thing to throw on top of that, too, that you need to be mindful of is that you're getting paid 1099, so you're not getting taxes taken out on you. So you're going to get one hell of a tax bill when you go file your taxes. And the other thing on top of that, because you don't have anything to deduct. You're not paying for fuel. You're not paying for maintenance.
Yeah.
You're not paying for repairs. You don't have any kind of tax shelter.
You're not getting
your
Obamacare. You're not getting anything. So, you know, at the end of the year, you know, unless you've been forced saving a huge amount of that, you've got to pay, you know, under FICA and those kinds of things. As an employee, he pays half, and half of it's deducted from you. As an independent businessman, you know, you pay more than half. I think, you know, you may pay something like 6.5% as an employee for Social Security, but if you're self-employed, you pay more like 9.5%. So every way come to Sunday, you know, he's saving about a third of what he pays you in taxes.
Yeah, he's passing his bill on to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's passing all the social welfare burden on to you, and you're getting none of the benefits.
All right. I sure appreciate it.
Well, I'm sorry to tell you that, but you know, and you know, for anybody else that's on here, you know, listen, I just have to take your questions as you see them. As people can probably tell, I don't pull any punches on them. You know, you tell me the way it is, and that's what I'm responding to. If there are other aspects of the case I don't know, then I really can't comment on it. But what this caller just said isn't to what I consider to be kosher.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we appreciate the candor of it because, you know, sometimes that's what we need. We need to get the straight dope. And we got another caller. They lining up for tonight, Mr. Seaton. We got Gavin calling.
Let's go.
Gavin has a question. Gavin,
yes,
you're on live with Rico and Hank.
Thanks for taking my call, Rico. How you doing, Hank?
Doing fine.
I'm going to pull the trigger on this thing March the 30th of this month. I'm going to go ahead and jump out there on my own. I have signed up the two load boys, and I've been calling brokers, getting them to send out fit-up packages. And I've been filling them out, reading over the contract and things. Is there anything else y'all would recommend me to do before I jump out there on my own?
Well, a couple of things. You probably do need to get the book because it does have the 13 things that you're going to be seeing in this contract. Now, realize that if you're jumping out here on your own, people are going to look at you as the last one they want to hire because most brokers want to see that the carrier's been around for a couple of years. You're going to have a high docket number. You're not going to have any safety profile. It's going to be tough. I would say that if you're jumping out on your own, wherever it is you're based, if you can make a personal touch with somebody that will give you your outbound freight or at least 50% of your business, so that you don't have to just bounce like a ping pong ball all over the load boards doing business with people you don't know, you'll have a whole lot better chance of surviving. Go ahead,
Mr. Seaton. I thought you were finished. Go ahead. I'll let you finish.
Well, I was just going to say, anybody who's just getting started might really look at something like the National Association of Small Trucking Companies and their new carrier survival training, which will, you know, help you with look at your costs, look at the drug testing, look at the new carrier audit, all of the things that have got to come your way. So you kind of, you know, in a couple of days are forewarned of what the government's going to do to you, what you can expect from shippers and brokers, what kind of books you have to keep. There's a lot to it.
I was going to purchase the book from your website, probably tomorrow from whenever business hours. I was going to purchase that.
I think it's really tough, Rico. You can comment on this, but I think it's really tough to just get all your loads off the load board and end up doing business with a different broker every day. I'm doing power only now,
and I'm finna cut the power only loop, you know, because they've been getting all my loads and I've been pulling their trailer, so I already have my trailer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of brokers have been asking me how long have I been in the business, but I've been driving trucks for 20 years, so, and I have my own authority for about 7 months now doing power.
Oh, okay, that's great.
When you mention
power only or with your own truck, there are some brokers who have dedicated lanes and who will use you on a continuous movement basis and those kinds of things, which can take some of the hassle out of it. They look at you as an excess capacity provider, and that might be the thing you want to look at, particularly if you find someone who in their contract doesn't look or they're trying to really drag you out. You'll quickly find people that want to work with you, and your good service should recommend you.
Okay, thanks.
And just to kind of wrap it up, Hank kind of hit all the points that I was going to say, but one thing just to kind of reiterate, I cannot stress enough, go and join NASTIC, National Association of Small Trucking Companies.
I already took their class, so I'm already up on that.
Right.
And I want to grow my business. Have you grown your business, Rico? Because a lot of people say that's the worst thing I could ever do because I'm going to have way more headaches. Just take one truck and one trailer.
Well, I'll give you this recommendation, Gavin. Go and pick up a book by Michael Gerber called The E-Myth Revisited. Go pick up that book, and he'll kind of, you know, listen to that if you're going to get it on audio book or whatever. Grab that book, and he kind of goes into the entrepreneurial myth and talks about and breaks down. If you're getting into the business as far as growing your business, you can't grow your business in the truck. You got to get out of the truck in order to grow your business. So you need to be, you know, and those are small things to a giant. You got to come out of the truck and begin working on your business versus working in your business. The longer you stay working in your business, you are staying on the proverbial hamster wheel. You're going to be running on that wheel. But if you ever want to grow your business, you got to get off from behind that truck. You got to get out there. You got to get out here, knock on some doors, and meet some people. And that was the only other thing that I was going to add that Hank kind of talked about. You know, go around and I think it's a waste of time to call brokers. If you're on a load board and you post your truck, the broker's going to call you. I wouldn't waste any time calling the broker. I would spend my time, if I'm going to be calling anybody, I would be calling and trying to solicit direct shippers to try to move their freight. That would be, if I had everything to do over, that would be where I would start. I would start trying to knock down and getting those direct contacts where, because like I say, once you post your truck on a load board, the broker's going to call you. So don't waste any time calling them. That's just my opinion.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the other thing is we've talked about this before. I think if you want to grow your business, finding a niche, you know, finding a corridor, a particular service, a shipper who can recommend you, it just takes one. But I think, Omaha tonight and Cleveland tomorrow, is going to get you pretty doggone road weary, wondering where the next load's coming from.
And Mr. Seaton, we still got quite a few people that are on the line. That's got some questions. I know we're getting close to that. We're getting close to that 1 hour mark. I don't want to disrespect your time. How are you looking on time? Are you can you stick around a little?
Oh,
while
I'm
longer,
okay.
I
can stay for a while. Let's get some more in if they've hung with us.
All right. that thing, but we're going to go to Melissa. Melissa is calling in. She has a question. Let's see if we can pull Melissa up. Melissa, you're on live with Rico and Hank. Hey, how you doing,
Aaron.
Melissa?
Thanks for taking my call. I'm sort of in trouble a little bit. I don't know. There's this broker that does a lot. Hello?
Yeah, I'm hearing
you. Yeah,
I'm going through the tunnel. Anyway, the broker has a contract, I guess, to ship in Michigan, and I had taken two of those pipes. One of them, as I was going through this, because the project is on the end of this residential street, and I was going down that street. Well, I could have taken another route, but I didn't. And one of the branches kind of scraped the top of the pipe, and it had a little flash in it. Now, these people say that this is major kind of, damage, and they're going to put the pipe up. They received the pipes, and they put them aside, and today the broker called me and said that the insurance claim has to be opened. They're not filing the insurance claim. They're just going to open up an insurance claim in case that they need to file, because they have other people also with the damaged pipes, and they're going to process all this at the end of something like that. Now, this is where it stands, and I'm a little bit worried what's going to happen. How are they going to know it's my pipe and how much damage is to that one pipe, and how are they going to all sort that out?
I can see where you got a real problem. Did you take pictures of the pipe before you left it?
I did, and
okay.
I called the broker right away, and I, send him the picture, and I send the picture to the insurance company, too.
Does the broker have any of your money?
They have, and I think what they're saying is they're going to process they're going to open up the claim, but they're going to pay me, so that the actual lien is not going to be against me, I guess, because now they have insurance company that they can deal with.
Look, I mean, all that's good, because very frequently most brokers would offset the potential claim against your freight charges and say, well, we got 9 months to file the claim, we're going to at least hold your money that long. The fact that they're going to pay you the money is good. They have 9 months to file the claim. If you have insurance, it sounds like the insurance probably won't have any exclusion that wouldn't cover this, because this is an actual damage to the pipe. If you provisionally turn the claim over or offered a notice of a claim to your insurance company, then hopefully at the end of the day, your insurance company will adjust the claim. The most you'll be out is your deductible.
Deductible, yes.
Yeah. So, you may have a $500 deductible, and that may be what you're out. You're in the best of all worlds in that the nature of the claim is one that usually your cargo insurance company will cover, and they've been notified about it early, so they've got their claims processing to it. And I would assume that it's this concrete pipe or metal pipe.
No, it's a fiberglass, and I don't see why they can't fix it.
Well, I don't know.
I don't know about
the pressure test and the extent of the damage and that kind of thing. If I were your insurance company, I would want to have the pipe sorted and inspected and not wait until the end of the time to figure out that they just made the decision that the pipe wasn't worthwhile. But all of that is for your insurance company to do. As long as you've taken the pictures and notified your insurance company, you've done basically all that you can do under the circumstances.
Okay, so they're going to follow through. Okay, thank you. That
Yeah, I hope so. Now, not all insurance companies are equal, and I'm not going to ask you on an open mic who your insurance company is, but, you know, that's what you buy insurance for. And it's not, there was physical damage, and you did you did hit an under, low-hanging branch. So there's not a coverage issue. So I think you're I think you're okay.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right, thanks for the call, Melissa. And we have got a couple more calls, but we got a question that came in from we got a question from Facebook here. Question that says wants to know about the provision in the CFR for terminating a contractor's lease that they have 14 days to return any company trailers. We give contractors 7 days to get out and we'll work with people on getting trailers back, but we have a fleet that we terminated and is claiming that they have 14 days and they will charge, the company is wanting to charge $100 per day for loss of revenue plus lease rate and don't want to look stupid in front of the FMCSA if they say something different.
Well, for whoever's on Facebook, the regulations are set forth at 49 CFR 376. That's 49 CFR 376. Anybody can Google it. If they do have my book, I go into a line-by-line explanation of what is in the Truth in Leasing regulations. The only time limit specified by the government in terms of for doing anything is that the owner-operator must be paid within 15 days of submission of his paperwork, and that upon termination of the lease, the owner-operator must have a final accounting, including an escrow accounting, within 45 days. Otherwise, to the owner-operator lease to specify upon termination when the equipment, the trailers, must be returned to provide when the decals must be removed. All of that is governed by what is in the signed written agreement. So, you know, you're not going to look foolish before the FMCSA on anything other than the 15 days to ordinarily be paid and the 45 days on settlement. I have seen what I consider to be egregious leases that say that, you know, if this is terminated, we've got the right to come get the trailer. You've got to bring the trailer back to the home base on your own steam. You got to get it here in 5 days, and the writs of replevant, and all kinds of things in the lease that are really pretty egregious. There may be some remedy on the independent contractor lease, because it's to be construed to be very favorable to the independent contractor, and deductions and those kinds of things are supposed to be really specified in detail. So whoever's sending this in may have some pretty good recourse if they're an independent contractor based upon how the language is worded. But just because it's stout language, if it's clear, in terms of turning in trailers and things like that, it may still be enforceable under the Truth in Leasing regulations.
Okay, yeah, this is from a carrier. This is a situation that he's going through with someone that was leased on to him. But I look like you kind of helped us out, kind of clear that up for us. Let's go back to the phone lines. We got Richard calling in. Richard has a question about driver pay. Richard,
okay,
you're on live
your
with me. Hank, how can we help?
Yes, I am. Thank you. I keep hearing all kinds of things on per diem. excuse me, not per diem. But the fuel surcharge. I get paid percentage of load, company driver. And some people say there's driver has no per diem, right to per diem. Others say they are. And I'm just trying to clarify it and figure out what's going on.
Okay, well, now, you know, you've mixed two issues. If you're paid on percentage, you can be paid on percentage and still, I think, be given a per diem allowance. As I understand it, a per diem allowance is really a tax issue. And it is a payment that can be made to an owner-operator that, I don't know if it's $37 a night or whatever, that the owner-operator doesn't have to declare as income. And from what I understand about per diem, it's recognition by the IRS that you can write off as an expense a certain amount every night that you're away from home as a business expense. And that's where I think the per diem comes in. And how it's worked between the carrier denominating it and you reporting it, I'm not exactly sure, but I do think that your accountant should know what per diem is. And when you go to fill out your taxes, to the extent that you can write off, well, it's $37 or $47 a night out of your settlements as money you don't have to pay taxes on. I mean, you know, it's a real benefit to you. So
right, I understand that. But on the fuel surcharge, because as I said, I'm a company driver, and the carrier I'm working for now says I'm not entitled to fuel surcharge.
Well,
and
why would
that.
You be? You didn't purchase the fuel.
Okay, fair enough. That was the main thing, because I've had truck driving lawyers undertake you have to and you don't, and I just don't like to act on anything unless I know for sure.
Well,
I have a...
you know, I have heard that there are some lawyers running around the country trying to get class actions against motor carriers to say that the owner-operator should get, he's paid on percentage, okay? Now, you say you're a company
right.
driver, but
right.
that the owner-operator is paid on a percentage. He's supposed to get 70% of gross revenue. Well, they say it's unfair then for the company not to pay him 70% of a damage claim or 70% of an expense that the company absorbed. So, in other words, let's say if a company billed a carrier or billed its shipper extra insurance or something like that, that was a pass-through that wasn't part of any work or any expense incurred by the owner-operator, that the owner-operator should get 70% of that, too. And I think that's really pretty crazy. It seems to me as though the way to interpret it is that if the owner-operator is going to be paid 70% of the revenue, that should be 70% of the line haul revenue and 70% of any
liability
charge incurred where the owner-operator did something. But, you know, if there is
right.
An extra charge for a hydraulic blower on an automatic tank, and that's passed through, I'm not sure I think the owner-operator should get that if it's a washout charge. So, you know, there is a problem with the fuel surcharge because increasingly, unless you say as a part of gross revenue that the owner-operator will be paid, you know, 1 cent for every 5 cent over, and then you back that out of the gross revenue, it gets really hard to figure out, well, carrier A's got a fuel, or shipper A's got a fuel surcharge, but shipper B doesn't. You know, how do you get apples and oranges all together?
That is true.
You know, you get 100% of the fuel surcharge, if any, otherwise you get 70%. And it just depends on how the shipper negotiated the contract, it seems like it's all over the lot. And, you know, I think their independent contractor agreements need to be clearer in terms of, you know, how to compensate the guy for the fuel.
I agree. It's a very clouded issue on a lot of items in the carrier business and truckload business.
To me, you know, it should be read really pretty clear. If the independent contractor, if it's a reimbursable, you know, if you're if you've got to if it is fuel and it's being charged and you bought the fuel, it ought to come through at 100%. If you're responsible, if it's per diem, and the thing says you get 70% of the per diem, you certainly ought to get it because you're the one that had to sit there and wait. If it's some expense that you didn't incur, like for a special trailer, you know, or size and weight permit that got passed through at cost, why should the independent contractor get 70% of a cost item that the carrier incurred? That doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
No, that doesn't. No, there's just a lot. You have carriers that are trying to shave. Everybody's trying to make an extra penny, a nickel, and stretch it as far as they can, and they take it from where they can, and you got to be aware of the law and what you have available to you and what recourse to you. But if you don't know, you can't take care of yourself.
The other important thing for people to remember under the truth in leasing regulations is that the carrier can't, you know, if he's going to give you a discount and he's getting a discount, he's probably got to pass along the same discount. You know, if he paid $1.50 for fuel because he got a discount, then, you know, you ought to be charged $1.50 for the fuel. Or the contract should say very clearly that you're getting a different compensation formula. There's an old case against Landstar where it was alleged that, you know, I think the independent contractor was buying insurance through Landstar, but he was paying more for it than Landstar was paying the underwriter. And, you know, the court said, well, that's not fair.
All right, created the extra profit center.
Yeah. I mean, it'd been a different thing. I'm not hitting on Landstar. It's an old case. It'd be a different thing if a carrier said, look, you can buy insurance through us, but we're going to charge an administrative charge of $50 a month. Otherwise, we're going to bill you what it costs us plus $50 per month. Then at least you know that they weren't creating a separate profit center. And you could go buy your insurance somewhere else, not pay that $50.
Right. Okay, well, Richard, we appreciate your phone call. We're going to move on. Looks like we got about two more questions here, Hank, and we can get ready to kind of wrap this thing up tonight. Just want to remind everybody, once again, we can give you your website again, www.transportationlaw.net. You can find information, all kind of transportation law information there at that website. Of course, we have the Racing Lanes Facebook group. You can go and like us on Facebook. Of course, you can look for me on Facebook, Rico Muhammad. You know, you can be social with us. You kind of get your questions ahead of time posted on those sites. And let's see here. We're going to go back to the phone lines. Caller calling in from area code 618. The caller calling in from area code 618. You're on live with Rico and Hank. How can we help? Hello, caller.
Oh, hey, Rico. I'm not in the queue. Come on, I keep getting put into it.
Okay. All right. Well, we appreciate it. I seen you had a jump on here, but we'll put you back on hold. All right. Well, let's go to Daryl. Daryl has a question here. Let's bring Daryl on board. All right, Daryl,
yeah, Rico.
You're on live with Rico and Hank. How come help?
How you doing,
yes,
Rico?
Sir, Daryl,
I had a
live
question. Yes, Rico, you just a moment ago, you had, about three or four callers back, mentioned about a book when the guy talked about growing the business. What was that book?
Michael Gerber. Michael Gerber is called The E-Myth Revisited. Was on the New York Times bestseller list for quite some time. It's kind of been called the Bible of small businesses. One of the best small business books. What Michael Gerber does is, kind of like a Cliff Notes version here on the air real quickly. Michael Gerber talks about E-Myth. E-Myth stands for entrepreneurial myth. And what Michael Gerber talks about in the book is that a lot of people make the mistake of they think that they're being entrepreneurs and they actually are buying themselves a job. You want to spend more time. Basically, the premise of the book is you have to do all the things of the entrepreneur is actually running a business. So you got to spend more time working on your business, developing your business, whether that means
right.
hiring employees, marketing, all of the things that comes along with being the entrepreneur, the leader of the business. He kind of goes in depth and kind of gives you a roadmap and guides you along the way on how you can adjust and make changes so that you're not the person, you're not the tactician actually in the job there doing the day-to-day operations. It's a really good book. I highly recommend it. Go check it out if you get a chance. They have it available on audiobook on audible.com. One of the most excellent reads that you will ever read as far as small business concerns that I've ever come across.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, man.
All right. Well, that answers your question?
That answered completely.
Cool beans. Well, we appreciate you. We got a couple more calls, man. We're getting ready to start to land this puppy. We're gonna try to bring a couple of these guys on and get out of here. But we got about we're gonna let Mr. Seaton go. And we're gonna land this thing. We got about 10 more minutes left here in the call, so let's jump over to caller calling in from the 806 area code. Caller calling in from the 806 area code. You're on live with Rico and Hank.
Yes, Rico, Hank. I have a question. The website is transportationlaw.net. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. I have a gentleman that's leasing on to me, and I am a lifetime member with OIDA, so I got their leasing agreement, but there's quite a few things missing in that. Do you have a general leasing agreement that we could buy from you that would cover everything that we need?
Yes, I do. One of the things that I've got to say is because state laws are involved with workman's comp and those kinds of things, I've got kind of a standard owner-operator agreement that takes care of the 20-part federal test, but I need to know to help you, what state you're in and be sure that it's modified so that you meet the workman's comp criteria there. There are some states, for example, that say that, a motor carrier can't lease, do a lease purchase deal with an owner and operator and still avoid workman's comp. So it's not one size fits all. You can contact me through transportationlaw.net and, I'll be happy to, at a reasonable price, help you with the contract. That's one of the things we do. Okay.
That would be great. The other question I have is, after a claim, we hold a load of windows for a company in May, and we hold four loads. First three loads arrive just fine. The fourth load, the gentleman that supervised the loading of the other three was not there, and there was a bunch of damage. That was in May. Since then, in November, I switched insurance companies, and I got a phone call last week from my old insurance company saying that there's been a freight claim for these windows made. Is there a time period for the company that we hold the windows for to file a claim, or can that just happen 6, 8 months, 2 years down the road?
Well, the statute provides that a shipper has no less than 9 months to file a claim. And actually, the nine-month rule is enforced as a matter of contract or as part of the Uniform Bill of Lading. If you look at your Bill of Lading, if one was issued, it probably has in the fine print that the claim must be filed within 9 months. So
yeah,
you know,
we just hand wrote our own bill of ladings on that, and it was just a gentleman's agreement that, you know, if there was any damage to the windows, they were going to be responsible for that. And obviously, that's where I screwed up. I shouldn't have trusted them, I guess.
Yeah, in the book that Rico was talking about, you know, for a carrier to publish service terms and conditions, they publish in the service terms and conditions that the uniform bill of lading will apply, and its 9-month rule is there. But the general principles of cargo claims are that unless it's shipper, load, and count,
which it was.
If it was shipper, load, and count, and you weren't there to watch the loading, then you have probably got a pretty fair defense that, you know, it was the way it was stacked and packed that caused the loss. But in theory, the words of SLC or words of similar import should have been put on the bill of lading. You know, that shipper load and count usually applies when you've got a spotted trailer and it's loaded and sealed when you get there.
That's what we did. We spotted the trailer. They would take the day. They would load it. And the windows that were broke were towards the center of the trailer, was my understanding. So, you know, we put the paperwork in the back door, put a padlock on it, and down the road we went. So we wouldn't have been able to see it anyway, you know.
Well, your insurance company, is your insurance company providing you with the defense? Your old insurance company?
When they called me, she asked me for my side of the story, and then she's supposed to get back to me. That's all I know.
Yeah, well, you know, what's going to happen usually is the consignee will get around to filing the claim within 9 months, and then the argument will be over whether or not it was actually shipper load or encounter, whether it was the fault of the consignee or whether or not you could have observed the loading and are responsible.
Okay.
And it sounds like getting an affidavit from the driver and documenting what happened is going to be a key to resolving it.
Yeah, well, I was actually there when I helped the guy pull the trailer out of the dock, and we closed up the doors and everything. And so, I can do that myself.
All right. Well, it sounds like you. The other thing is, when you don't have a chance to observe the loading and those kinds of things, when you sign the bill, put down your name, the name of the carrier, and the word SLC.
Okay.
Because that stands for shipper, load, and count. And there is a statute that says that when the word shipper, load, and count or words of similar import are on a bill of lading, a carrier is not responsible for the count or for upset to the trailer or for damage to the goods that result from the loading.
Perfect. Now, one other quick thing, if you've got a minute. When I talked to the gentleman from OIDA, he mentioned the workers' comp for the owner-operator. So I got a hold of my insurance company in Washington, and they have recommended a insurance policy. It costs about $160 a month, but it gives $1 million worth of protection if the guy falls off the truck. Otherwise, my insurance company said it was just a $5,000 or $10,000 PIP that would go towards paying for the medical bills.
Let me ask you a question. You said Washington. You're talking about Washington State?
State, correct, yes.
Okay, Washington State is not a very happy place for the independent contractor model. I told you when we started this that workman's comp varied by state. I would think that it may be very tough to avoid workman's comp in Washington State. I think what your agent is talking about is what's called occupational accident insurance.
Yeah.
And in many states, what you do is you require the independent contractor to buy OCAC.
Right.
The reason
that's what we
is
were gonna
the premiums.
Do.
The premiums are a whole lot less than they are for workman's comp. And if he has OCAC and he's injured on the job, there's really not a whole lot of incentive for him to come sue the motor carrier. The reason the OCAC premiums are less than the workman's comp is because independent contractors, if they stump the toe, they don't take 2 weeks off.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
They have less claims. They're more entrepreneurial in spirit. So purchasing OCAC is an important defensive mechanism to a workman's comp claim.
Now, should I also do that for myself, being the owner of the company? I don't pay workers' comp. They don't accept it from me anyway. So I was looking at acquiring the same insurance. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, you know, if you're exempt under the statute, then what you're doing is you're just making a risk analysis.
Right.
You know, is it worth it to you to have what amounts to a disability policy?
Right,
you know, I assume you're going to have health care to take care of your injuries, but, you know, it may be a cheap form of disability insurance and something you want to look at.
And whether we're going to get these policies in the driver's name, but like the insurance and everything, we as a company actually make the payments and then we deduct that from our owner-operators. Is that still considered
legal? In the lease, and I'm sure the OIDA lease probably goes into this, you can't require the independent contractor to have to buy OCAC through you. You can give him the choice. He either gives you a certificate showing that he's bought OCAC, or he can buy it through you, but at that point you've got to give him the deck page and proof that he's actually got it, and you need to, I think you were probably on the line when we talked earlier, be sure that he's paying the actual premium for it.
Right, okay.
And of course, you goose up his revenue so that, you know, every driver needs it, but you know, it's ultimately it's cheaper coverage for everybody.
All right. So
all right,
that
thank
has
you,
that, and we're gonna thank you, and we're gonna give Daryl. Daryl's gonna get the last word tonight. You're gonna be the last caller. We're gonna get through. Daryl, you're on live with Rico and Hank.
Rick, could you just answer mine?
Oh, okay, we got to you. Okay, we had a caller that was in there I was trying to get to, but that I guess that wraps it up. So, okay, well, Hank, we knocked out all of the calls tonight. We had a couple more, but we don't want to overburden you too much more. But do you want to give out any closing remarks, anything you want to
say?
I think
the only thing I would say is for anybody still on the line, do you believe that the FMCSA today has come out with an app for every shipper, broker, and insurance company's phone that will let them check every carrier's SMS scores at the drop of a hat? They are still insisting that shippers, brokers, and carriers have an obligation to cull the herd based on SMS methodology, even though everybody knows that it's rigged to fail and doesn't accurately predict safety. So I guess my comment for the night is expect in the last or in the next year to see a very active Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration before we gear up for the 2016 elections, making it much more difficult or small businesses. We just got through making comments and an advance notice of proposed rulemaking in which they want to increase the amount of insurance that carriers would have from $1 million to as much as $9 to $10 million. The cost of that would be prohibitive and would make our friend who's just going out on his own impossible to get insurance and get into the business. I think we're really at a turning point in which if something doesn't happen, it's going to be really tough for people to get into trucking, and I'd like to read that book on entrepreneurship. I think trucking has created a great living for a lot of folks that didn't have to go to Harvard Business School to run their own businesses, and I just think all of that's in peril. I mean, Lord knows we don't have to worry just about ISIS and what's going on abroad, but what's going on here is crazy enough. So with those hopeful words, I'll sign off 30 minutes late.
Yes, sir, Mr. Seaton. We appreciate all your time once again.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Hank Seaton that was joining us tonight. He's been once again, please go and purchase his book. He's going to be coming out with a new book. We forgot to ask him about it tonight, but he's going to be coming out with another book here shortly that he's been working on. But go to his website, www.transportationlaw.net. Wealth of information on there. You can always catch Hank here. He usually joins us on the third Wednesday of every month. We have him on. He's here to answer your questions. And just like you said earlier, he doesn't hold any punches back. He gets straight to it, and you get a great opportunity to ask someone that's an attorney to get your questions answered and not just lunch can of banter. We are already over time. We're going to wrap up tonight. We want to thank everyone that helped make this program possible. We want to thank my wife, Lasagna, my lovely daughter, Fatina, for helping screen calls. Thank Kevin and Lisa Rutherford and the entire Let's Truck team. This is Rico Muhammad signing off live from Atlanta, Georgia, wishing you all good night and be safe out there. God bless you. Thank you and good night.
Bye, Rico.